Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoyed the program. Time to catch up with a little Australian religious news now, and we're joined by the presenter of the Religion and Ethics Report on ABC Radio National, Andrew West. Andrew, good to have you back.
Always great to come back.
Andrew, there's been a few things since we spoke last time, some local news and information, also a little international stuff that's maybe relevant to Australia. First, though, the big continuing story is religion and the census. That is, how have Australian attitudes to religion and the practice of religion changed in the past 5 years?
I think the real story is the growing group of people who identify in the census as having no religion. Not necessarily atheists. On our program a couple of weeks ago, we spoke with Professor Gary Baumer, no stranger to this program, and Gary pointed out that this group that describes itself as no religion, which is around 22-23% of the population, the second biggest group when it comes to religious identification, is not necessarily godless. They're people who may be toying with spirituality, but overwhelmingly
People who sort of don't go to church, don't practice.
They're people who don't practice, who don't feel they fit in with an existing institutional church, and yet they have not rejected the notion of divinity or spirituality.
So how many would say they are atheist?
Well, this is very interesting. We don't yet have the specific breakdown because there is a provision in the census where you can specify atheist. What we do have, though, are the results of the 2006 census, and a mere 31,000 people wrote atheist. Now, Gary said, let's just be generous, let's double it. Say it's now 62,000. You're still talking about a tiny fraction of people who are sufficiently motivated, maybe sufficiently definite or even doctrinaire,
committed
even doctrinaire in their atheism to say so. So I think this notion of atheism as being, you know, sort of inexorably on the rise is checked by this data. That said, Christianity has fallen as an identification for many people. It's now 61%, and Catholicism among Christianity, Catholicism at around 25% remains the single biggest group, followed by the Anglican Church at around 17-18%.
It sort of fits anecdotally with the sort of conversations we have on a program like this, who quite often conversations with listeners begin, I used to go to church, but...
Yes, well, part of this 22% of no religion could be the shakeout of people who carried their religion and their denominational identification rather lightly. People who were nominals, as the sociologists and demographers say. So maybe what we're getting are a smaller group of people committed to a particular denominational identification, but they're becoming a little more definite and committed. So there's a bit of a shakeout.
Yes, you could also get a shakeout from those who are definite and committed about their religion and sufficiently attuned to it to be able to say, I am not comfortable with the way the institutional church is expressing itself.
Yes, interestingly though, in a piece that Gary Baumer wrote for Eureka Street magazine, he pointed out that the church where you would think there would have been the greatest disillusion, and that would be the Catholic Church because of the endless litany of sex abuse scandals and now money scandals, that would weaken. Now, the Catholic Church has fallen a little in numbers, but it also found, largely through immigration, 300,000 new adherents in Australia.
But you're dealing with a different phenomenon there, aren't you?
You're
dealing with a phenomenon where your Western Celtic, Anglo-Celtic Christians may be actually rejecting, but that's being supported by a new ethnic colour.
Yes, that's right. And the Catholic Church in particular in Australia is becoming an ethnic church, a church bolstered by Filipinos, Vietnamese, some members of the South Asian community, Chinese. So yes, the church, it's finding new adherents through the immigration story. That is maybe keeping, I think I've said on this program before, groups like the Uniting Church in the game, because they're about 5% according to the census. They'd probably be lower if it weren't for Koreans and Pacific Islanders. So it's very much a mixture of the immigration story as well.
What about the geographic distribution of belief?
That's very interesting. That's come out in a subsequent tranche of data from the Bureau of Statistics. And in a sense, there's no surprise. What it shows that the most irreligious communities, and they're in Sydney, I think it's Darlington, Newtown, Enmore, Forest Lodge, places clustered
around. Oh, we're talking about your latte set.
Well, quite. In Melbourne, it's Fitzroy.
God, I can tell you. North Fitzroy, Carlton.
Clifton, you're right. Clifton, you're right. Melbourne. Although the most irreligious place in the country is apparently Nimbin. Now, and funny, isn't it? Because in a strange way, going back to the 70s, we think of Nimbin and the Aquarius Festival, and that had so many...
New age,
but it had a very religious feel about it, didn't it? Now, it may have been a rather flimsy religion. At the other end, the most religious places in Australia are Indigenous communities. You're registering their Indigenous faith at up to 99% of the population. And in Sydney, the other place that makes it into the top 10 is Greenacre, a suburb that has been settled very, very intensely by Australians or new Australians from the Muslim world.
This says something very interesting about religious commitment, that the strongest religious commitment may no longer be found amongst Christian communities, but religious adherence at its strongest may be found among those who follow other faith traditions.
Absolutely. And the other interesting statistic to come out of the census was the almost doubling of the Hindu community. Now, that's partly through immigration, but also through a deep sense of observance. There's another interesting wrinkle in this too, John, that diasporas around the world tend to cleave very strongly towards their religious groups because they are a sense of continuing identity. But the community, the country they've left behind, still dwells in them, and it's expressed through their religious observance.
And in some way they become more orthodox than the folks they left behind.
Indeed.
Now, there's a continuing story that we shall doubtless
it is indeed
have more to say on. Another big story that has a resonance for Australia is what's been happening on the sex abuse crisis. We've had an Australian story running this week, but there's a shadow story with interesting parallels in the United States.
That's right. This is the story of Monsignor William Lynn. He has become the first church official in the United States to be jailed, not for being a sexual abuser himself. He is not guilty of sexual abuse, but he was charged and found guilty of child endangerment because it is said that he knowingly transferred priests who were known sex abusers, shuffled them between other parishes. Again, Monsignor Lynn, not a child abuser himself, but had effectively, not willfully, not deliberately, but effectively enabled forms of abuse to continue by taking a priest and thinking, well, out of sight, out of mind, we'll move you to this place, and the priest offended again. This is a really important story because it's the first conviction of its kind.
And it takes the arm of the law into the church hierarchy.
Well, yes, and there's some real conjecture as to whether this would have reached even further up into the hierarchy of the American church had Monsignor Lynn's boss, Cardinal Bevilacqua, not died only in the last few weeks or months. Now, Cardinal Bevilacqua was both a civil lawyer and a canon lawyer and delighted in telling people that. And there is some view that maybe Cardinal Bevilacqua knew a lot more about the offence records of these priests. And had he survived, we could well have seen the conviction or prosecution of a cardinal. And a cardinal takes you, I mean, then you're getting into
the Pope.
Yes, then you're getting into the Pope, yeah.
And of course, hearing that story, it then gives people cause to speculate on what's unfolding in Australia.
Yes, there is this ongoing controversy that has erupted since that that very shattering Four Corners story a couple of weeks ago about the priests in who heard a dispute there. Now, there are disputed versions of this confession by a Father F, who was a priest who allegedly confessed to various awful sex abuse instances against boys. Two of the three priests say he admitted enough for us to become very alarmed, and we did act, and they did act. But then a third priest says, no, a whole lot more was admitted, and now there's the issue of whether those priests had a duty of care to report this to the police.
So then gives us the similarity to the American case. They may not have been, in this case, people who committed offences themselves, but knowing of those offences, if they did, and not reporting them, opens up the Monsignor Lynn scenario.
That's quite possible. That is quite possible.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio around Australia through Radio Australia and via the web to the world. We're talking with Andrew West, presenter of the Religion and Ethics Report on ABC Radio National. Let's go overseas now, Andrew, and take us to the rapidly changing world. The conflict in Syria continues to horrify people. We see President Assad apparently this week again manoeuvring to say, we can begin conversations about a resolution, Russians shifting their position. Some are now beginning to speculate that what Assad may have in mind is a reversion to a communal settlement not unlike that which existed under the French in the 1920s.
And not unlike that which is really unfolding in neighbouring Iraq. That's right. You effectively have a very religiously divided population in Syria. It's 75% Sunni Muslim. It's 10% Christian, 12% Alawite, which is a breakaway from Shiaism, but considered heretical by many, and about a third who are Druze, who are also very distant relations of Shia. And, you know, there is this thought that maybe the most practical thing to do is to carve up the country into Sunni sections and Shia sections and Alawite sections, where the Christians would go because they're a much more broadly dispersed community. We don't yet know. I mean, there's a strong Christian presence in Damascus. There's a strong Christian presence in Aleppo. I was in Syria 3 years ago and witnessed this myself. They're strong and vibrant communities, but they're dispersed. So it may be very difficult to do, but it may be the only practical solution.
And some are suggesting that this gives you a coherent explanation for the sort of violence that's going on. It's about clearing the ground for different groups to actually get their territory and hang on to it.
Well, one of the interesting factors about Syria is that you have concentrations of villages that are almost entirely Alawite or almost entirely Christian or almost entirely Sunni, and that has led to this communal violence. The other interesting possibility that's coming out as a possible settlement, and Kofi Annan suggested this, is the idea of a more confessional form of politics like you have in neighbouring Lebanon, where certain posts in the government are reserved for certain people. So in Lebanon, it has been, I think, since about 1943 and then reaffirmed in the 70s, the case that the Maronite Christians have the presidency, that the Sunnis have the prime ministership, that the Shia have the speakership of the parliament. So you get that political settlement. But of course, it does require then, it's essentially anti-democratic, because it requires you to relate along tribal and religious lines rather than having a politics that's based on differing sets of values.
You went some way to providing some interesting insights into this dilemma with a guest you had on the program just a couple of weeks ago.
Yes, Professor Mark Juergensmeyer. He is the director of the Orfalea Center for International Studies at the University of California. He's also the author of a new book about the religious challenge to the secular state.
And you asked him the question about whether or not this was a religious conflict. And he had a very interesting observation. He said that, look, at heart it's not. It's just that religion gets used as the veneer.
Yes, he said these conflicts, and you're seeing it also a bit in Nigeria, We've looked at Nigeria in the past couple of weeks as well. But going back to Syria, these conflicts take a tribal or economic or ethnic grievance. And in his words, they religionize them. He's coined that phrase. They religionize them. They tack on these elements of great cosmic battle to give some sort of...
Forces of light and
darkness. To give forces of light and darkness to what are otherwise very basic tribal disputes. In Africa, you often see it over access to resources, and they evolve into these nasty tribal religious motivated conflicts, but they don't start that way.
The church has its own sorts of conflicts, and England has been grappling with one for some time, which has some resonance for we here in Australia and across the world. It's women bishops.
Yes, the General Synod of the Church of England met at the weekend and then early into the week, and before it, everyone thought was going to be a final resolution of the ongoing debate about whether there ought to be women bishops in the Church of England. Well, they did the Anglican thing and put it off. They postponed the decision.
Another committee.
They postponed the decision again. Now, the supporters of women bishops were the ones who agitated for this debate to be delayed and this decision again. This is partly because the settlement, the compromise that they were presented with as part of the final settlement, they felt would entrench a system in which women were considered second-class bishops. And it was basically that a small rump, somewhere between 3 to 5% of Anglicans in Britain, who are not only opposed to women bishops but opposed to women priests, said, well, what if our parish doesn't want the supervision of a female bishop? We want a male bishop. And then they went a bit further and said, we want a male bishop who's never ordained a woman or who's never been ordained by a woman. Well, of course, that then creates the need to establish effectively a parallel church within a church. And that means, you know, this church within a church doesn't recognise the religious orders, the ordained status of some people, and it all gets very, very messy. So the women said, look, this is going to make us second-class bishops. Let's put this off until we try to get a final resolution. Well, they've set November as the deadline for that. But given this debate has been going on for 15 years, I think they'll be lucky to see that resolved in November. And Rowan Williams had really wanted that to be one of the crowning achievements of his term of Archbishop, which ends at the end of the year.
So he loses his covenant and he loses his settlement.
Yes, I mean, it will look again as though the Anglican Church has waffled and has, you know, it's a constantly sort of indecisive organisation, and it makes it look very woolly to outsiders.
Well, this attempt to prevent a split has all but failed in the United States.
Yes, the United States really started to break down about 20 years ago as far as the unity of the Anglican Church. You had the development of something called the Anglican Church of America, which was basically a group of uber Catholic high church Anglicans who didn't want women. They didn't believe in women's ordination. They broke away. More recently, you've had another group called the Anglican Church of North America, which has a rather more pluralist position on women, but has broken away from the Episcopal Church over issues of sexuality. And they installed Bishop Bob Duncan, who was a mainstream Episcopal bishop in the United States until a few years ago. They installed him as the primate of the Anglican Church
of
North America.
So they've now set up their own parallel, well, separate church, basically.
Yes, in fact, they are not in communion at this stage with the Archbishop of Canterbury. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the instruments of communion that makes you an Anglican. Very interesting little wrinkle here, John. The Anglican Church of North America also goes into Canada, and it covers those dissenting conservative parishes that didn't like the direction of the mainstream Anglican Church in Canada. And there's a priest who is the rector of St. John's in Vancouver, Canon David Short, and his name comes up again and again in various rumours and speculation as a possible Anglican Archbishop of Sydney.
When Peter Jensen retires.
Yes, next year.
Now there's something to watch. There's a big church bash in Australia this week as well coming up.
In Adelaide, it's the 13th triennial Congress of the Uniting Church of Australia. The Uniting Church, as I say, now represents 5% of Australian churchgoers, a decent enough group. But the Uniting Church has really got to look at its direction, at its philosophy. The man they're entrusting with the new direction is the Reverend Professor Andrew Dutney. He's a theologian. He's obviously a Uniting Church minister. He's also a bioethicist, and he'll be installed as the president of the Uniting Church for the next 3 years in Adelaide this week.
It's interesting. He's got a background in ecumenism, which these days is the area over which many churches are floundering, because some churches want to take a progressive position, now the churches want to take a more conservative position. So the tensions between churches, where there used to be a sort of genuine stress across churches to move together, is now actually to define their distinctives.
Andrew Dutney will also have to manage this continuing rupture within the Uniting Church of Australia, where you have a conservative, or what they would describe as a biblically orthodox group, and I think we need
confessing
congregation. Yes, and I think we need to respect that description of themselves as biblically orthodox, and they have become effectively a church within a church. They're following very much the model of an American writer whom you'll remind
like Thomas
me.
Thomas Oden.
That's right.
Turning around the main line.
Yes, that you stay within your institution. You don't split. You stay within and work towards, if not becoming the majority, then growing your presence within that organisation.
A continuing issue again to watch. Andrew West, great as ever to have you with us.
And great to be here
as ever. Think about.
It's a pleasure, John.
Andrew West from the Religion Report on ABC Radio National. This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.